This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Or pledge online at kpft.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, and this is Club Evolution, where we explore social change through the historical recordings housed in the Pacifica Radio Archive, the oldest collection of public radio programming in the United States. Today's guest host is Tori Osborne. Ms. Osborne is the author of Coming Home to America, A Roadmap to Gay and Lesbian Empowerment. She is the former director of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Community Services Center, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and stands as a vital and highly visible leader in the gay rights movement. Today, she is the executive director of the Liberty Hill Foundation, a unique partnership of donors and community activists working to build a new Los Angeles based on a vision of social and racial equality, economic justice, and a shared sense of social responsibility. And now, Tori Osborne and Club Evolution.
Hi there, I'm Tori Osborne, and for the past 44 years, Pacifica Radio has opened its microphones to discuss and record the struggles of sexual minorities and the social and political war waged against them. Today, we will focus on the lesbian experience within the feminist and gay rights movements of the 1970s.
I was born in 1903, and in the 20s, it was just kind of taken for granted you were a lesbian, you were a lesbian.
Nobody talked about sexuality, let alone homosexuality, so most of us went through that period where we, I am the only one, the only misfit. We didn't even have a word for it.
And they called her in and told her that unless she gave the names of 10 of her friends, they would tell her parents that she was gay, and they would dishonorably discharge her.
Pat, did you ever lose a job because you were gay?
Yeah.
In the 1950s, a small group of women formed the Daughters of Bilitis, the first lesbian organization with chapters in cities throughout the United States.
It's 1972. They don't want to let up on us, do they? They just don't want to give us a chance, man. It's a drag. That's all I can say. I'm very sorry that it was killed. We all thought the times are right.
I've seen some gay people fall into what I think is the assimilationist trap by saying things like, we're just like everybody else, or we're just like straight society. Well, I don't think we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, this public hearing is being continued in connection with intro number 475, which, in summary, there will be no discrimination in employment because of race, creed, color, national origin, sexual orientation, or physical handicap.
How could they vote anything down? Well, they're taking their tax money, right?
Exactly.
They're very ignorant. They should be educated on these things. This is why the generation that is here today is about to overthrow the damn government. When you take away a person's rights, it's not democracy anymore.
During the 50s in the village, I didn't know the few other black women who were visibly gay at all well. Too often we found ourselves sleeping with the same white women. We recognized ourselves as exotic sister outsiders who might gain little from banding together. Perhaps our strength might lay in our fewness, our rarity. That was the way it was, downtown.
In the Bay Area in 1981, we can be more open and honest about our lesbianism than at any other time in recorded history.
I remember the first time I walked into a gay bar, and just the whole complete sense of relief that I got. It was just like being washed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was what I was supposed to feel when I got baptized.
Mm-hmm.
The year? 1981. The place? Berkeley, California. In the documentary 12 Years of Lesbian Activism, producer Ginny Z. Burson and host Lula Frogged look back at the significant events that surround the gay rights movement. Also included is a rare roundtable discussion with pioneer lesbian activists that offers a rare account of what it was like to be a lesbian before women's liberation and the gay rights movement began.
Went out last night with a crowd of my friends. They must have been women, 'cause those like no man. It's true, I wear collar.
Lesbians who were not supported by men were always in the workforce. During World War II, when men went overseas and women were recruited to work in the war industry and in the service, lesbians jumped at the new opportunities that were offered to them. But life in the military was no better, and in many ways it was worse. Pat Bond talks about lesbian purges in the 1940s.
And we all really cared. We were very patriotic. We cared. You know, we were very involved in the war and trying to win it, and it was our country, and da-da-da-da-da, and Hitler was on the march. We were the first contingents of WACs to arrive in Japan. Of course, we only had an all-women's band, you know, dressed like knitted black pants with the stripes down the side and bow ties, and danced together. I mean, our officers were all gay. There was no mistaking it. And then suddenly, one of the women that I was billeted with, whose name was Helen, she was in love with a woman, and yet she was sort of in love with a guy. She didn't know what to do. And this is an adolescent phenomenon we know about, which spells suicide now, but it didn't then. And they called her in and told her that unless she gave the names of 10 of her friends, they would tell her parents that she was gay and they would dishonorably discharge her. Well, they had read her mail. They had listened in on her phone calls. And then one at a time, they called all of us in. And we didn't even know we could have a defense. We thought that being queer was indeed like having the plague. And so it never occurred to us that anyone could defend us, that we had any rights at all. And so there you were, terrified. Now, one woman even went out and got herself pregnant. We were so terrified. And you thought that your best friend, you thought everybody was the enemy. And you were always trying to outguess, is she listening into my conversation? Is there anyone I can trust? Who can I talk to? And then Helen jumped out of the window in the sixth story where she lived. Finally, they sent us all back, 500 women for dishonorable discharges.
Listening to Pat Bond talking about the 1940s, I can't help but think, first of all, those brave dykes, you know, the ones that went before us, the shoulders on whom we stand, and how much has changed, really how much has changed. We've seen in a relatively short period of time how much has changed, and yet how much remains the same. It's still women who are more harassed and witch hunted in the military. It's still witch hunts under don't ask, don't tell, you know, this unenlightened codification of the closet. It's still lesbians who suffer more than gay men. We still see teen suicide. You know, she talks about the lesbian killing herself. Three times the national average, and the national average is bad enough. And we still see what lesbian poet Adrian Rich called compulsory heterosexuality, where women essentially are socially conscripted into roles and try to go straight or play straight in order to avoid the pain of homophobia. So it breaks my heart, and at the same time, you do have a sense of the march of history and moving forward, and over the generations, there's definitely been change.
In the 1950s, a small group of women formed the Daughters of Bilitis, the first lesbian organization with chapters in cities throughout the United States. Women like Del Martin, Phyllis Lyon, Barbara Greer, and others active in this organization pioneered lesbian and women's rights. In 1956, DOB started publishing The Ladder, which was for many years the only lesbian publication in the United States, and which was the first to disseminate positive images of lesbians. Still, most lesbians met other lesbians at the bars. Pat Parker describes the bar scene.
I remember the first time I walked into a gay bar, and just the whole complete sense of relief that I got. It was just like being washed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was what I was supposed to be when I got baptized.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I remember that, just all of a sudden looking around and seeing women who dressed like I did, you know. And in reality, there was very little between us, you know. I mean, there was a whole lot of class difference and whatever, but there it was, you know. And that feeling kept me in the bars a lot longer than I should have stayed there.
My first bar, lesbian bar experience is not all that much different from hers. It was the late 60s, and I remember it was one of these mafia-owned, seedy, smoky bars with that you can't tell it's a bar from the outside, and you had to do a secret pass or something. I don't know. I was with a friend who did some secret knock to get in, and it always felt like it was all wrapped up in a brown bag or something. You know, everything was closeted, and there were raids, and you were afraid of raids. And I can remember a combination of feeling imprisoned and relieved. And I really think that was the state of life for those of us, sort of pre-gay liberation, pre-feminism, is that to find that you weren't alone. You know, when your only experience of lesbianism was, you know, reading that horrible book, The Well of Loneliness, that we all, was the only thing we all had in 1967, 68. So things, even when I, in my generation, and I'm 50, but so in the late 60s coming out, hadn't even changed that much. It really all happened with the social movements of the 60s. It really radically changed where there were other social spaces and people could move from the bars into the streets and into the suites.
The year is 1977. The Women's Caucus of the National Gay Task Force is formalized. Anita Bryant, orange juice pusher and born-again Christian, becomes the front person for the Save Our Children campaign, a national movement to push lesbians and gay men back into the closet by denying them equal rights in employment and housing. Lesbians start working with gay men in large numbers for the first time in years, but gay rights initiatives are defeated first in Dade County, Florida, and then in Wichita, Kansas, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Eugene, Oregon. Despite the defeats, there are some positive aspects to the campaigns. We are reminded of how tenuous our legal rights are. We are able to see the extent of our support, which 10 years ago would have seemed impossible. And for all those lesbians who still think they are the only one, there can no longer be any doubt that we are everywhere. In 1978, the issue comes up again, this time in California. The Briggs Initiative would require firing from the school system any known lesbian or gay man or anyone who advocates support for lesbians or gay men.
This last poem I will dedicate to our good sister Anita. It's called For the Straight Folks Who Don't Mind Gays But Wish They Weren't So Blatant. You know, some people got a lot of nerve. Sometimes I don't believe the things I see and hear. Have you met the woman who's shocked by two women kissing and in the same breath tells you that she's pregnant? But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or this straight couple sits next to you in a movie and you can't hear the dialogue because of the sound effects. But gays shouldn't be blatant. And the woman in your office spends your whole lunch hour talking about her new bikini drawers and how much her husband likes them. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or the hip chick in your class rattling a mile a minute while you're trying to get stoned in a john about the camping trip she took with her musician boyfriend. But gays shouldn't be blatant. You go in a public bathroom, and all over the walls, there's John loves Mary, Janice digs Richard, Pepe loves Dolores, etc. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or you go to an amusement park, and there's a tunnel of love, and pictures of straights painted on the front, and grinning couples coming in and out. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Fact is, blatant heterosexuals are all over the place. Supermarkets, movies, at work, in church, in books, on television, every day and night, every place, even in gay bars. And they want gay men and women to go hide in the closets. So to you straight folks, I say, sure, I'll go, if you go too, but I'm polite, so after you. Thank you.
I can remember Pat Parker doing that poem. I saw her on several stages do that poem. You know, it's hard to remember back, I think, to that period of time of lesbian and feminist culture. It was quite extraordinary. I was, at the time that Lesbian Concentrate came out or that Pat Parker was doing that, I was running. I was in a lesbian collective that was running Holly Near's record company. And it was the time of women's music, and it was this flowering, this unbelievable flowering of lesbian culture, and there were lesbian coffee houses and concerts and festivals, and later produced the West Coast Women's Music Festival with Robin Tyler. And it was a time when we were finding our voice, our voices, our multiple voices, and really an incredible flowering. And when we look back now from the perspective and recognize that it was exactly during the late 70s that the right wing was reconsolidating for its bid for power in 1980 with Ronald Reagan, and then beyond, it was sobering. But the reality was we had that time in the late 70s and mid 70s when men and women did come together around the Briggs Initiative and around Anita Bryan. And one quick Anita Bryan story, I was in Chicago working with a lesbian group called Blazing Star, and we organized, all these women went to the, where'd you organize? You organized the baseball fields and in the bar. So you would get all these women and we'd go out and demonstrate when Anita Bryan came to town. And my lover was a photographer, and I wish I could take credit for this, but somebody in our group took a pie and threw it right at Anita Bryan and got her right in the face. And we got the photograph. My lover got the photograph. We sent it out to all over the press, and it was all over the press. And I got to write the headline of my life, Anita Gets Her Just Desserts.
How much is this voice you've been listening to worth to you? I'm Brian Levinka of Queer Voices. This hour, KPFT is featuring voices like this as a part of our membership drive. Sounds like this are saved from the abyss every day by the Pacifica Radio Archives. But the archives isn't like Santa's Workshop, where elves are free labor and every kid wants a wooden train. A voice like what you've been hearing is expensive to restore. So, how much is this voice worth to you? Would you put a quarter in your radio every day to make it come on? That's cheaper than a payphone these days. Yet you can turn on the radio every day, seemingly for free, and enjoy great programs for hours on end. For a lot of people, that's where the relationship ends. But for a very special group of people, the relationship changes over time. People like you become attached, start to know the announcers by name, know when a membership drive is coming up, and astonishingly, give us money. They willingly pay for something that many people get for free. Those are the very special people. We call them members. We need you to become a member this hour. These voices mean something to you, and you know we are not Santa's Workshop. We depend on financial support to save these sounds. Please make a pledge of support. Join KPFT today by calling now, and welcome to the club. Here's the number to call.
As Brian said, that number is 713-526-KPFT. This is not, sadly, Santa's Workshop. It is something that the tapes don't move themselves, and this type of audio does not protect itself on its own. It requires people like you, those of you who are willing to step up and make a pledge of support. The program you're listening to, narrated by Tony Osborne, shares with you some of the history of what lesbians and gays in the recent and more distant past had to struggle with. You're listening to the program Queer Voices, which you'd normally hear at this time. However, we're sharing with you audio from our past and our future, our histories as movements, our histories as people, our histories as a community of individuals, whether you're gay and GLBT, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, whether you're not, whether you're somebody who just cares about justice, whether you're someone who cares about good storytelling and things that are fascinating, and things that offer you a glimpse into the lives of people who maybe you don't know, but who touch you in some way, shape, or form, because that type of voice matters. This radio is non-commercial. It's educational. It's commercial-free. It is listener-sponsored, and this type of radio is the way that radio is meant to be heard, where voices get to come to the table and talk and share perspectives and learn about each other. That's what non-commercial radio is all about. We're asking for you to make a pledge of support right now to get the gift that you've got a chance to hear a little bit of this hour, and we'll get to hear a little bit more of in our next break. But right now, we need to ask for your pledge of support. The number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Two of the biggest misconceptions of non-commercial radio are, one, that someone else is going to pay for this kind of radio, And the second is that the government pays for this radio or bankrolls it. The reality is that one of every 16 listeners is the one that supports KPFT. Our listener base versus our actual listeners is a fairly large ratio. And so we need to ask you to go to your phone and dial 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, because you all are the ones that ensure that recordings like what you're listening to are protected. This type of audio needs people like you. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting spends per individual per year about $1.53 for every single non-commercial radio station in the United States. $1.53. I don't think you can get two things on iTunes for $1.53. And yet that amount of money goes for every individual, for every single radio station that is of a non-commercial nature for the entire year. And now, if you want to decide you want to break that down for KPFT, I mean, you can take out a penny if you've got it in a very large knife and try to cut a little tiny sliver, because that's essentially what KPFT is getting each year from the federal government. Over 90% of KPFT's operating expenses are funded by you, the listeners. Supporting things like the Pacifico Radio Archives comes from people like you. You cannot depend on the next person. You have to depend on yourself. And we need you to go to the phone and dial 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. A really engrossing interview from lesbians talking about what life was like in the 30s and the 40s and what that type of existence was. We're going to jump back to the interview. The program is narrated by Tony Osborne, noted lesbian activist as well as author and organizer. But right now, we're going to jump back to that program, and we need to ask for your support. 713-526-5738. Please give that pledge of support. 713-526-KPFT.
Led by a coalition of lesbian and gay school workers, the Briggs Initiative is soundly defeated. The following year, San Francisco's gay supervisor, Harvey Milk, is murdered, and lesbians and gay men march on and riot at City Hall. Lesbians Against Police Violence is formed to monitor and protest the growing police violence aimed at lesbians after women are harassed and beaten at Amelia's and Peg's Place.
When I was working with Holly Neer and other lesbians and doing Redwood Records, just the same time Jenny Burson was part of the Olivia Collective, Olivia Records, that when Harvey Milk was assassinated, we were up in Ukiah, because that's where Redwood Records was based, the town that Holly Neer had grown up in. And we got the phone call that Harvey and Moscone had been shot. And, you know, we knew he had to be with the gay community. Here we were up in a canyon 2 hours north. And Holly and I jumped into my car, and we drove, headed down to San Francisco. We just had to be with people. We were grieving. And we sat in the car, and it started to rain in California, and there was this rain coming down, and we didn't know what to say, and we're sitting in the car, and all of a sudden this noise starts coming out of Holly Neer, and it sounds like keening and moaning, and this almost unearthly animal sound comes out of her for about 35 minutes, and then at the end of it, the words come out. We are gentle, loving people, and we are singing for our lives.
And we are singing for our lives.
Land of many colors.
We are a land of many colors.
And that night she sang that song that became the anthem of the gay movement at the Candlelight Memorial for Harvey Milk. We're going to step back to 1972. The Vietnam War still rages. President Richard Nixon visits China and the Soviet Union. It's just 3 years after the Stonewall Riots, which arguably marked ground zero for modern gay liberation. Lesbians and gay men are more visible than ever. They also find a voice. They protest, demonstrate, and perform acts of civil disobedience for the rights of sexual minorities. In New York City, a clash between city officials and activists leads a woman to chain herself to the mayor's desk. At Pacifica Station WBAI, those involved recount the events.
Ladies and gentlemen, this public hearing, which was commenced on October 18th, is being continued in connection with intro number 475, which, in summary, is the purported local law which would amend the administrative code so that there would be no discrimination in employment, places of public accommodation, resort or amusement, and housing accommodations, and a commercial space because of race, creed, color, national origin, sexual orientation, or physical handicap.
I personally am holding Lindsay responsible for this. At least for one of her three people in that committee voted against me because he would not let his commissioners testify. And he would not support the bill. We've spoken to him in private and several times. And Lindsay gives this beautiful minority speech. Yes, I support this, I support that, but he hasn't spoken to anyone. His last election is proof that man is capable of political miracles. And he just completely won't do anything in this case.
Gay Women's Liberation Front is in the process of drafting a statement to all California feminist women's liberation groups in the hopes that they will do what they can to support the gay actions in solidarity with their lesbian sisters in New York. And hopefully we will also have the women in California zapping Lindsay along with the gays.
Approximately 10 people went down to City Hall. They posed as a journalism class from Columbia University, claiming to have a meeting with Mr. Laird, who's press secretary for the mayor.
The women were all wearing skirts and eye makeup. And they didn't know it was us. And the men were wearing suits. And we looked, I'm sure we looked considerably more distinguished than most journalism classes. So they should have caught on from that.
They went to the gate at the north wing. There's like gates inside City Hall which block off the wing. Small gates, you can hop over type gates. And two of them first, one man and one woman, explained that there was journalism press and everything. They let the two of them in. They headed immediately for Lindsay's office, where the woman involved managed to chain herself to Lindsay's desk itself.
The first person in the history of the city ever to chain themselves to the desk of the mayor. And the very funny thing was the policeman, the security guard, had been called and he just couldn't do anything to a woman. He just stood there looking at her. And she hadn't chained herself, but Ron Gold, the other gentleman that was there, he was fumbling with the only other thing to tie himself to, which was a radiator. So the policeman ran up and dragged him out of the office and completely left Carol there. So in the meantime, she chained herself to the desk. And then about that point, outside, the others, I think there were six left, the other six that were outside at the gate to the north wing, which is Lindsay's wing of City Hall, when they heard Tom being called, Nat Rockwell, vice president, said, this is it.
As soon as the people waiting at the gate outside at the good old journalism class realized that they had been discovered and everything was blown, so it was time to shout, they promptly chained themselves to the railing, the little gate area. Coral Parada being smart enough to chain the gate closed, so that when they got rid of the brother who had gotten into the office, they had to do so by passing him in the air over their heads. He promptly went out the front door, around the block, and in the back door, until he was discovered and thrown out a second time. They finally got clippers and whatnot, and the press was running out of the press room like crazy. They got clippers to release the, you know, to cut the chains and everything. At first they weren't going to arrest them, but then they decided there were so many photographs taken that they just had to arrest them. So seven people were arrested at City Hall in the morning.
And City Hall was very upset. They really were quite startled when they saw what we had done. And they, as we were led away, eventually, after having made our point with much cheering and shouting and judicious use of wire cutters or those giant
snippers
that finally the police dug up from someplace and they had to snip 7 large chains and led us away to the basement. The police were pointing us
back?
Out to each other. We'll get them back after the trial. Apparently, it's the evidence. The police were saying to each other, that one chained herself to Lindsay's desk, and they were really impressed.
One incident that took place is in one of the back offices, there was a woman at a typewriter doing some work, and some of our people were speaking with her and mentioned the 20 million homosexuals in the United States, to which she responded, "You mean the 20 million fags?"
One particular thing I would like to remind people that in that 20 million, there are fags and dykes.
Yeah. Right on.
And unfortunately, we have sexism within sexism.
In 1975, lesbian feminist theorist Charlotte Bunch is interviewed on the series Gay Alternatives by Ronald Gold. Today, Ms. Bunch is the executive director of the Center for Women's Global Leadership at Rutgers University.
Hello, I'm Ronald Gold, and this is Gay Alternatives, a weekly show about the variety of ways, both traditional and experimental, that gay women and men are attempting to live their lives. About the ideas that gay people are using to work out these personal lifestyles, and about the things these ideas and experiments may mean for the future, not only for those who define themselves as gay, but for women and men in general, for the society at large. My guest tonight is Charlotte Bunch, a resident of Washington, D.C., a former writer for The Furies, editor of the feminist magazine Quest, a member of the board of the National Gay Task Force, and, according to most of the women I know, this country's foremost lesbian feminist theorist. Charlotte, I'd like to begin by asking you a question which may be so all-inclusive that it's meaningless, but I'd like to give it a try.
Okay.
What is a lesbian feminist? Surely it isn't just a feminist who happens to be a lesbian, or a lesbian who also happens to be a feminist.
Okay, that's a good place to begin, because it's, in part, a lot of the work that I've been doing and a lot of confusion that exists in both the feminist movement and the gay movement. Lesbian feminists originally were those women who came out of either the gay movement or the feminist movement and felt that one or the other of those movements didn't address the other half of their oppression. So, in essence, it did start out to be pretty much those feminists who were also lesbian and those lesbians who were also feminist. However, over the years, I think it has developed to be also not only a community, but also a politics or a particular political perspective on the oppression of both women and homosexuals. I mean, the essence of that perspective is simple and would seem to be something that I think any feminist or gay man who develops a political analysis could agree with, which is that both of those oppressions are rooted in sexism and the institutional form of that, which I call patriarchy or male supremacy. But the problem comes in, you know, the development of what that analysis means. For me, the main part of that analysis is that neither the oppression of women nor of homosexuals in general can be eliminated without eliminating sort of both of those, what I call the twin evils of heterosexuality. And I don't mean, when I say that, I mean heterosexual domination and the exclusive and dominating influence of heterosexuality as the only way to live, and also the way that all the institutions of society are structured, and the male supremacy, particularly the form of male power and male privilege as has been analyzed in the last few years.
I'd like to go on a little bit with this business of what used to be called separatism and mm-hmm. and then the whole question of alliances and so forth. I think at one time you might have described yourself as a separatist.
Right.
And do you now?
Well, it depends on how you use that word. I don't, in the sense that I work with other people besides lesbian feminists. I have some difficulty because I think the word has come to mean a number of different things.
Well,
like
that's
so many of these
exactly
words.
Why I brought it up,
right,
because I want to see what it does mean.
Okay, well, the word separatism to me, when I was a separatist, meant a particular strategy. It meant that we as lesbian feminists needed to have time and space alone to develop both an ideology and a community, and that the community was in many ways just a building of our own sense of self-worth and pride and our own power as a group.
The ideology was the development of the analysis that I've spelled out some here and that is going on in mine and other people's work today. So for me, separatism was never a final goal, but it was the necessity, as many movements in this country have had to do over the last, well, not even just the last 10 or 15 years, but in fact, throughout the history of this country, people who wanted social change have used what I call the tactic of or strategy of separatism, which is to pull yourself into a separate group, develop what you want in a community, and then when you have a certain amount of power and clarity about what it is that you're doing, you move back into larger other movements or even the mainstream of society and begin to demand those changes as a whole.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio Archives Club Evolution. For copies of this program, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 800-735-0230.
If you go down to the woods today, you're in for a big surprise. If you go down to the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every dyke that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the lesbians have their pick.
Happy lesbians.
Every lesbian who's been gold is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play. Beneath the trees where nobody sees, they'll hide and seek as long as they please, cause that's the way the lesbians have their picnic.
Next is a program from 1978 called The Lesbian Underground. At Berkeley Station KPFA, Sabrina Sojourner moderates a panel discussion with the founders of the Daughters of Bilitis, Pat Bond, Phyllis Lyon, and Del Martin.
This is Sabrina Sojourner welcoming you to Lesbi Friends. Lesbi Friends is a new program on KPFA produced by the Lesbian Task Force of the San Francisco Commission on the Status of Women. Today's program is with Pat Bond, Del Martin, and Phyllis Lyon. We will be discussing the lesbian underground, or, in other words, what it was like to be a lesbian before the feminist and gay liberation movements. I would like to give you a brief description of the three women that I will be talking to. Pat Bond is a comedian, and she was in the film The Word Is Out, and has been performing across the country in several different nightclubs since her appearance in the film. Phyllis Lyon is commissioner for the Human Rights Commission for the City and County of San Francisco. She is also on the staff for the Institute for the Advanced Study of Human Sexuality and has co-authored several books, including Lesbian Woman, with our third guest, Del Martin. In addition to being a writer, Del is commissioner for the San Francisco Commission on the Status of Women. Welcome, ladies.
Hiya. With a real broad general question, what was it like before the women's movement?
You just said the key word, broad.
Yes.
Open your mouth to say broad anymore, you get stoned.
That's
love
true. Pat,
what was the joke I just heard? Oh, it's neat. This woman goes over to a friend of hers house who just had twin babies, right? She said, how marvelous. She said, you had a woman and a little boy.
Yeah, this seems to be a real thing of when do you start using the term girl and woman and all of
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Pat, you were in the service, and you talk a lot about that in the film. Well, not a lot, but that you gave a lot of insight to a lot of different people about your experience in the service. Could you talk a little bit about that?
It was a bummer, you know. First of all, a lot of women, I think, or a lot of young people, want to get away from home. How do you do it if you haven't got any money? And at that age, you want to get away from home. And of course, I had fallen in love with a woman who was not crazy about me. So the thing to do was join the Foreign Legion to forget, you know. But the Foreign Legion wasn't open to women. So I went into the Women's Army Corps, which was total error. It was 90% gay. And once they got us in there, and in that era, we were very obvious. I mean, women dressed like men in that era. So they were being recruited dressed like men. Men's haircuts, pinstripe suits, the whole bit. And they took us in like that. And once they got us in, they said, my God, it started a witch hunt the like of which you've never seen.
What time frame is this?
1943, 44, in Tokyo.
That voice is the sound of innovation. It's different than inventing a ball or a gadget, but it's no less innovative because it brings you something far deeper. Ideas, perspectives, new visions for our world. Sounds that change the world are what this hour is all about. My name is Geraldine of Govegan, Texas. KPFT has been featuring selections from the Pacifica Radio Archives, which preserves and protects special old tapes that would not otherwise be available without your support. When Sir Isaac Newton was congratulated on his groundbreaking discoveries in physics and mathematics, he gave credit to the scholars before him, saying, "If I have seen further, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." This reminds us of the many, many listeners who have supported KPFT and the Pacifica Radio Archives with gifts both small and large over the years. Those listeners have truly made this station all that it is today. If you've never before given to KPFT, you have the opportunity now to take the achievements of this public radio station even further by standing on the shoulders of all that past generosity and making your first-time contribution. This programming means something to you. For a few pledge levels, you can get a great gift and a thank you gift as well. Please go to your phone now. Thanks. Here's the number to call.
That number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make that contribution to this radio station. Again, that number, 713-526-5738. That is your number to call right now. Please go to your phone and dial 713-526-5738. You are listening to Tori Osborne narrating The Lesbian Experience, featuring a wide variety of interviews brought to you by the Pacifica Radio Archives. The Pacifica Radio Archives is likely the one and only place where you will find some of the very first interviews conducted on non-commercial radio with the GLBT community. I would certainly encourage you to look around, but I do not believe you're going to find audio this deep, interviews this historic, or voices this provocative elsewhere, but right here on KPFT, the home of GLBT radio right here in Houston. This type of audio is what the Pacifica Radio Archives has been built on. Everything from Charlotte Bunch to many of the other voices that were featured during this segment. We're asking for your pledge of support to continue this type of programming to ensure that these voices come to you now and in the future. I want to send a thank you out to brand new member Patrick, who joined the family this evening during the program. I'd love to thank you next. Please go to your phone and dial 713-526-5738. You can pick up a copy of this program, The Lesbian Experience. Ask our volunteers at Pledge Central for it. A few CDs that are available for your pledge of support. We can get a lot of great CDs for a $60 pledge. You can get the From the Vault full 100-hour CD set for your pledge of $200. You can just give a tax-deductible contribution for $35 and get a basic membership. However you make that pledge, please go to your phone right now and dial 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make that pledge of support. We do need to hear from you right now, 713-526-5738. And with that, we will wrap up this program, The Lesbian Experience, narrated by Tori Osborne. We will be featuring in the next hour the one and only Quentin Crisp. You'll want to stay tuned for that at the 9 o'clock hour, but right now we need to ask for your pledge of support. 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make that pledge. Please give us a call. 713-526-5738. We return to The Lesbian Experience, narrated by Tori Osborne. Please give us a call. 713-526-5738.
Del.
You're on. Well, I have no experience with the services.
Thank God.
Yes. From what I hear, I was lucky. But I'd just like to say that, you know, in the days that I grew up, it was nobody talked about sexuality, let alone homosexuality, so that most of us went through that period where we, you know, I am the only one, the only misfit. And when we didn't even have a word for it, We didn't know what the word about the word homosexuals or lesbians or anything like that. And finally, I guess somebody had pointed me at the direction of the book Well of Loneliness.
Yeah.
So that sort of spelled it out for me. And then I go to the library, and what do I find? Just a lot of discussion about those perverts and so on, people that I certainly couldn't identify with.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Francisco.
Hmm. What was San Francisco like at that time?
Well, around in the 40s, I remember there was a bar called Mona's.
Yeah.
Really a tourist trap. They used to let us in for free because we were part of the attraction. They had female impersonators. Male impersonators, excuse me. Then we were part of the sideshow. They had a fee to get in and so on, but for the tourists. And we were part of the show. That was about the only way you had of meeting anybody. It would be to go to a bar. And then we did find some other bars later and found that they were being constantly raided. You never knew when the paddy wagon was going to show up in front and just officers come in and load you all in. And the charges were absurd, like something like visiting a house of ill repute. And we formed the Daughters of Bilitis back in 1955 and began to locate attorneys that would tell us what the law really was to help us fight these cases.
Phyllis, when did you discover that you were a lesbian?
That's a good question. Actually, when I met Dell, she seduced me, really.
The truth comes out.
We were working together in Seattle, and one night, she and another woman and I were out having a few drinks and so on, and however the subject came up, I'm not really sure, but it did. And she said, well, she was a lesbian, which was fairly fascinating, I think, to both of us, because I'm not sure that prior to that time I was even aware that lesbians existed. I mean, talk about being sheltered from the realities of the world. So then we were really good friends for about 3 years before we finally got together. And, you know, when I look back on it, I know, you know, that I was gay all the time. But I didn't know that. I always liked women a lot better than men. They were much more fun to do things with. But nobody ever told me I had an option. And so, but I was going to say something in relation to what Dell said about the 50s, which was that when we came down here from Seattle in 1953, we didn't know any gay women down here. And so we were hunting everywhere, and you just could not meet. I mean, you'd look at women who looked like the stereotype, and you'd wonder and wonder, but, you know, outside of going up to them. I remember working with a woman who dressed in pants and a jacket, short hair, and I threw out the word gay to her in every imaginable way I could. And she never picked up on it, right? And I come home and I say, Dell, I'm just sure she is. But but it, you know, we were so happy when somebody suggested we should get involved with starting this new group, which turned out to be Daughters of Bilitis, because we figured we'd finally meet some more lesbians.
How did DOB come into existence, and what did it do in terms of providing an alternate social structure for lesbians?
Well, it started out as a very secret social club, and we were meeting in each other's homes and having parties at home where it was safe as compared to the gay bar. And then we began to have a lot of discussion about, you know, how did we cope in this anti-gay world. And we began then to publish the Ladder, which started out as a newsletter, and started putting on public discussion meetings. But there was no way that we could let the public know about these meetings, because the papers weren't picking up on anything like that. So you just put the word out into the network, and what happens then, of course, you have a gay audience there as the public, but that was helpful to those people who were so afraid. They could pose as the public, and we could be giving them information that would be helpful to them.
Pat, did you ever lose a job because you were gay?
Yeah. What happened was, of course, we don't talk a lot about it because the gay movement's been struggling anyway, but there's internal gay problems. Like, gay women can get mad at you if you say, gay men, I no longer wish to be your lover or whatever, and they will do darling little things like that. And I had a woman that I had been with who called up and told my boss, and she also told my parents. We haven't been discussing these things, but now I think that we've defeated six. It's important to start beginning to talk. I don't know if you guys agree.
No, I do.
That we can talk now about the internal problems of gay. And it's, I guess, any minority group. We can't get our anger out, so we tend to pick on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or have. And I think that's one of the things Daughters of Bilitis did, was to begin to let us have a support group.
Sure, and that is so important.
Yeah, so that you don't treat each other so badly. To say, hey, I care that you're in trouble. Because before then, it was every person for themselves. Build your own safe little world and try to, you know, hide in it.
Right.
Because nobody's going to really help you. You're on your own, Toots. You may have a lot of gay friends. I did. I came here about 1947, I guess. And I went to Paper Doll and all the bars. And I knew a lot of people. But close friends who were supportive, who cared about you, maybe one or two over the years. You know, so it was rare, no matter what you were up to. So I think that's why Daughters of Bilitis helped so much, the beginning organizations that said, let's try to be kind to each other. Let's try to figure out how we can help.
It also was an avenue for people to women to meet each other who were not as outgoing as you, Pat.
Yeah.
Because I know Dell and I went to the bars too.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat there and we watched all these different groups and wished somehow we could get involved with them, but really felt much more like tourists because we were too shy to go over and say, hi there, you know, what's going on.
Or go up and ask somebody. We didn't dance in bars in that era.
Right.
But, I remember we used to flirt with each other in the mirrors. And then you'd ask the bartender to send her a drink. And turn your back deliberately. And then the bartender would tell you how she received, not the bartender, because women weren't bartenders, but the waitress would tell you how the person had received your drink. And then you might move next to them and begin to flirt a little. It was neat then, because we flirted a lot. And women, I think, have forgotten the lost art of flirting. And I say, hey, you know, you can dance with me. So we used to use the eye bit and the eye contact, and the whole trip was neat. And of course, you were terrified because you had to be cool. See, most of us were butches because it was deadly to be a femme, as it's deadly to be a housewife trapped. It was the same kind of trap.
Mm-hmm. Right, so, you had to just sit there waiting for somebody to do
come
something
along
to you.
Everybody turned out to be butch because the butches didn't have to work either, which was neat. We looked so bad that they wouldn't hire us anyway. The femme supported you, right? Unless you were stupid, you quickly became a butch.
You see, I was born in 1903, so I would say from the time I was 14 on, I knew it. But I didn't know what it was called until I was older. And in the 20s, it was nothing to be one. I mean, it was just kind of taken for granted if you were a lesbian, you were a lesbian. But
was there a lesbian community in the 20s?
We straights and lesbians were all together. The straights had no feeling about it, and we had no feeling about it, so there wasn't a community in that sense.
How did you find out what a lesbian was?
I fell in love with a woman who was quite a bit older than I, and she gave me a play to read called, I think it was called Diana, which was in New York City at that time. And she explained to me then that that's what we were. So from then on, I knew that was in the 20s.
What would you say is the most important difference from being a lesbian then and being one now with the women's movement, gay liberation movement?
Well, now it really is a community, I think. I mean, I know about 20 to 25 young lesbians who are good friends of mine, and we tend to be together because, it's just like a community. And I think it's much more open in some ways, certainly in between the time. Now, you see, I lived in Germany for 8 years, studied there, and before Hitler, there was no feeling at all about lesbians. In fact, two of the doctors, the best known doctors in town, were lesbians. I was in love with one of them. And people, straight people, were proud to go to their parties and all that sort of thing. So that it's different today. There's a closer feeling. And I like it.
People forget that we're the only minority that's born into a hostile situation, or at least where we're invisible. So isolation is the primary, kind of oppression that gay people experience. Even today, I think, although it's changed so much, and there's community, and there's the internet, and there are the institutions, the 10,000 estimated gay and lesbian organizations and institutions for support, each person still has that struggle. And just listening to this woman talk from her era, each person has that struggle from isolation. You really do grow up, and almost every gay person has the experience of thinking they're the only one. I'm the only one. I'm queer. I'm odd. I'm different. Even today, it's changed enormously, at least in this country. It's changed, radically changed in the last 30 years. But it is a reminder that invisibility, isolation are really the sort of primary experiences of people who are born into an institution, the family, where presumption is heterosexuality. So you're queer, you get no emotional support, you get no role models, you get no external validation, and you have to self-create it. The art of creating community is one that we have had to learn for survival, and then it's become the brand of our political work. If there's one thing that this community has, I think there are a lot of things, but if there's one thing that queer people, that GLBT people, that gay and lesbian people have to contribute to sort of human evolution, aside from, the family diversity and our talents, and the fact that if there is a gay gene, it's the gene for fun and all that good stuff. It's really the art, the skill of building community, because we have had to for our own survival, our own psychic survival.
I was serenely independent and content before we met. Surely I can always be that way again. And yet I've grown accustomed to her looks, accustomed to her voice, accustomed to her face.
Audre Lorde described herself as black lesbian, mother, warrior, poet. However, her life was one that could not be summed up in a phrase. Author and poet, she exposed herself and the medical establishment by documenting her 14-year battle with cancer in her books The Cancer Journals and A Burst of Light. In the following excerpt from 1989, Helene Rosenbluth interviews Audrey after the publication of her first novel, Zami, A New Spelling of My Name. Since her death in 1992, Audre Lorde's poetry, essays, and novels are as popular as ever and continue to inspire new generations of readers.
Zombie first began as a series of stories. And what happened was I'd gone to an MLA, the Modern Language Association meeting, 1977. And I went to a meeting of a very large panel discussion. And a young black woman stood up and said, I'm a lesbian feminist literary critic, really asking myself a question whether it's possible to be that and survive. It was Barbara Smith. But I was so taken with this young woman's beauty and her bravery, and also the fact that that was really a question. And I thought to myself, all right, Audrey, there's some things that you just have to be saying. There are a couple of stories you have to tell. This young woman needs to know. Of course it is. It's hard, but it's certainly more than possible. And we got to be friends, and I got to know her, but that always stayed in my mind, and I wrote a couple of pieces of that. But it really started being a biomythography. It started being a concentrated body of work after, in the period when I was recuperating from my mastectomy, after I found out that I had cancer, and there were a lot of things, some of which I talk about in the cancer journal, which is a step-by-step, really, account of both the psychic and the physical healing. There are some other aspects, and I think probably physiological, but also emotional, of the real despair that centers upon one when we are vulnerable, that we're surrounded with so much horror so much of the time, and we all use various ways of keeping it afloat, of keeping it separate from ourselves. When you must attend one particular thing, as for instance, how do I plan my meals so that I make sure I'm not continuing to poison myself? How do I mend myself physically? It's as if you withdraw a lot of attention from keeping this stuff fielded, and it really all comes in. And I think there is that, and I think also that perhaps one of the real effects of cancer is an increased vulnerability to the kind of despair that we have to recognize and fight all the time. It's that I was fighting it less, or perhaps fighting it in a different way. And at that particular point, one of the things that I needed was to reaffirm for myself the ways in which I had worked through difficult times in my life before. I was surrounded in that period with so many really loving women. When I say that it's the love of women that saved me, I really mean that. But I also needed to recognize that it didn't just happen then. And these two things, these two elements just really came together. The thing that had happened the year before in MLA, my sense of the stories, and at that point it was that I needed to tell these stories for other people, for young black lesbians who were growing up, to say that, hey, this is how it was. Not how it was for everyone, but this is how it was for me.
What you've just heard has probably educated you in some way. Maybe it opened you up to new possibilities that you had not previously considered, confirmed things that you may have thought. Whatever the case, the power of radio is touching lives, no matter who you are or where you are. I am Ray Hill of The Prison Show on KPFT Houston. Research has shown that the main difference between non-commercial radio listeners and the general public is that listeners like you typically have more formal education. You don't need a college degree to benefit from what you just heard. The essential sound saved by the Pacifica archives or programs you hear on KPFT. You just need to desire to learn. KPFT adds to your formal and informal education every day. It is solid and serviceable education. We teach you the stories, the history, the culture that you will not get in school. No matter how many textbooks you have cracked or term papers you have written over the years, non-commercial radio listening continues to educate you day after day. Restoring voices like you've just heard and broadcasting them as we have is a costly project. Finding discontinued equipment to record the tapes, refrigerating rooms to ensure that they don't warp, and of course the people to make all that happen. All of that adds up. But we do it because those voices mean something to you. A good idea will last forever. And we at Pacifica Foundation preserve it in the voice of the original thinker. I'm Ray Hill. Thank you for listening.
That number to call right now is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support. Getting to the close of our day one, Spring 2008 Pledge Drive. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director here at KPFT Houston's wonderful Montrose Studios. Queer Voices is the program, and we're asking for your pledge of support. You've had an opportunity to hear the documentary, The Lesbian Experience, narrated by Tori Osborne. You can get a copy of The Lesbian Experience for your $60 pledge. We will be bringing you a version of From the Vault, the one-hour weekly Pacific Radio Archives program. This edition will feature Quentin Crisp. You can pick up a copy of the Quentin Crisp program, as well as the From the Vault 100-hour CD set, available for your pledge of $200. The number to call right now, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make that pledge of support. Again, 713-526-5738. With that, we go to Quentin Crisp, but we need to ask again for your pledge of support. 713-526-KPFT. Please stay tuned to KPFT Houston.
This week on From the Vault, we listen to the voice of one of the most unique figures of the 20th century, Quentin Crisp. Mr. Crisp died in 1999 at the age of 90. The city of New York, his adopted home for the last 18 years of his life, held a memorial for him soon after his death. A remarkable collection of people came to give their remembrances, and Pacifica was there to record the event. Today we bring you that event, along with selections from Quentin's one-man performance and Evening with Quentin Crisp. In the 1920s, without the benefit of psychoanalysis, community centers, support groups, or self-help books, Quentin Crisp defied those who despised him for walking the streets of London looking, in his own words, undeniably like a homosexual person. His very existence, his survival, was his defiance. He was at the forefront of the struggle for gay and lesbian people simply to be. In short, he personified the line penned by Shakespeare, "To thine own self be true," and gave the ideals of civil disobedience and nonviolent protest new significance. The following program is a recording of the memorial service held in New York City, March 3, 2000, and explores the legacy of Mr. Crisp through the remembrances of his family and closest friends.
You've been hearing it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York.
It was Quentin's lofty goal to meet everyone on Earth before he died. In a sense, friends were a hindrance to this ambition. "I like my friends," he would say, "but I adore strangers."
He was outrageous and wild and all over the place, but he just had these exquisite manners.
Take a look around the room for a second at each other, and isn't it amazing that we have one variety of everything here? It is amazing, all because of one man, and I think that's beautiful.
There's a wild rumor going around London that the Queen Mother died 17 days ago, but they put her on ice until August for her 100th birthday. And I thought, isn't that just the sort of gossip that you would love to tell Quentin Crisp?
He was a great and gentle man with probably the most focused identity of our time. He gave so tirelessly to everyone he could and left quite a hole in our universe with his passing.
My name was, as you'll know if you read the book, my Christian name was Dennis in a time gone by.
My father, Louis, Quentin's elder brother, not elder brother, but 1 year older, I was his first child, and I could have been called Louise after my father, Louis, or Geraldine after his brother Gerald. But I was named Denise after Dennis Quentin. Even one of my grand nephews is called Quentin. Quentin's family loved, respected, and admired him. And I'm really impressed to see so many people who felt the same about him. Well, I didn't get to see him very often because I lived in, and I still do, lived in South America, but we wrote to each other very often. And his letters were obviously very witty, full of wisdom. But something that perhaps not many know, they were very warm and caring. He used to sign them, Quentin, oh sorry, Uncle Dennis. When he still lived in England and working as an artist's model, for instance, he wrote, "They don't really need models, but I have become a sort of status symbol, a naked Cadillac." After a short visit to New York, he advised me, "Now that I am back, I am writing all about it for the English papers and advising everyone to leave for America at once." Finally, when his dream came true and he came to live in New York, and I was going through some difficult circumstances, times, his letter to me read, "If you possibly can, you should come here, though I am aware of your difficulties. Everyone is rich, and everyone is handsome, so you could marry almost anybody within a week." But it was the caring behind the one-liners that touched me. When my husband, whom he had, my first husband, whom he had never met, died suddenly in 1973, his caring and tenderness was one of the things that helped assuage my grief. Well, I'm about to become emotional, which I'm sure my very English uncle Quentin would have abhorred, so I will leave it that way there and will miss him.
I have now been to various places, including New York, which I'm able to tell you, if you don't know, is just like heaven.
Performance artist Penny Arcade.
I met Quentin almost immediately when he came to the East Village, but I didn't really get to know him until the late 80s. When Jack Eric Williams would bring him to all my shows. And I was stunned by Quentin when I finally did get to know him, because when I would just see him in the street, I thought, oh, that queen, you know. Well, I mean, I was raised by gay men, so, you know, I'm very dishy and judgmental. And when I did get to know him, I was stunned by his non-elitism, by his egalitarian spirit, that he was truly that person. And in 1993, for the last performance of Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore, he and Marianne Faithfull were in the show. And in the middle of the show, I asked Quentin if he would promise to live to be 100. And he said, "Yes, I promise I shall live to be 100, Miss Arcade." Shortly before that, he had named me as his anima figure. He called me up and he said, "Would it be all right with you if I name you as my soulmate for the London Sunday Telegraph?" And I said, "Yes," and I was, of course, incredibly pleased and honored, because, you know, I did know that Quentin and I shared a lot of things in common. There were all these different things that I thought we had in common that would make me his soulmate or his anima figure. Then I got mailed the page from the magazine. It was a Sunday magazine for the London Sunday Telegraph. And the quote from Quentin was, "Most people would be horrified to be publicly identified by me as their soulmate. But Miss Arcade is impervious to embarrassment." Somewhere in this time, Quentin came under a lot of fire from gay activists. At the time, I had a very aggressive attitude about gay politics because all my friends were dying. And by 1992, I had lost over 200 friends. And I often didn't understand Quentin's position on it. He would say, well, when I was young, syphilis was all the rage. And I did understand that, in fact, he was over 70, actually over 80 at that time. And I know that people stop changing when they're 25 or 30. So, I mean, to imagine somebody at his age, I would imagine that he had a position on things. And at that time, he said to me, because he would always say that gay people weren't real. And I had a problem with this. And he would say, well, if the opposite of gay is straight, then the opposite of straight is crooked. If the opposite of real is imaginary, I don't mind being an imaginary person, but I don't like being a crooked person. He called me up and he said, Miss Arcade, I know I've always promised you to live to be 100 years old, but I was wondering if you would give me a dispensation so that I only had to live to be 90. And I said, well, Quentin, okay, you can die at 90 if you want, but it's only 2 years from now. I said, you can't leave the planet until you debrief us on this horrible so-called postmodern era. And he said, well, what's postmodern? And I said, I don't know. I don't believe in it. And he said, I don't believe in it either. And I want to say that Quentin's great legacy is in his writing, and that everyone can have a personal relationship with Quentin through his writing. And I encourage you, if you haven't read him, to read him, because he was what we all want to be. He grew up to be himself. And that is the greatest thing that anyone can achieve.
I mean, modern science is so unkind that one might live to be 90.
Director of the Quentin Crisp Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, Louis Coilani.
I'm not bragging, but merely brimming with joy when I say that Quentin wrote of our friendship. I can think of no higher compliment than to be immortally linked with Quentin through his books. Two of my favorite heroes are Quentin Crisp and Shakespeare's King Henry V. An odd pairing, for Quentin was as gentle as Henry was warlike. Henry's cause was to conquer nations through force and violence. Quentin's cause was to educate his oppressors through the art of self-expression. Yet as different as they were, both of my heroes found themselves outnumbered and fought against the odds. In a famous speech from Shakespeare's play, King Henry rouses his army by invoking two early Christian martyrs. Their names were Crispin and Crispian, and they were brothers. I like to think that as a young man, Quentin, who was often beaten bloody in the city streets merely for being himself, borrowed his last name, Crisp, from these brothers, these two courageous men, whose brains were dashed out on the streets of ancient Rome because of their beliefs. And Crispin, Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. From this day to the ending of the world, Quentin lives on through us, and we few here tonight, we band of brothers and sisters, we carry on.
Everyone is fascinating who can be got to talk about himself. This is the thing. Nothing is boring except a lie. If you can get people really to tell you the truth about themselves, then they're all interesting. More than that, they're all fascinating. So that as far as I'm concerned, if I've hungered for success, it's because it will bring me to more people. As far as I'm concerned, that's all there is. To spread yourself out to the utmost limit before the largest number of people.
The following two speakers are Quentin's longtime friends, Mr. Evan Thompson and Mrs. Joan Thompson.
In the summer of 1982, our son, Owen Thompson, who regrets that he can't be here tonight, but he's in rehearsal, asked Mr. Crisp if he would play Lady Bracknell in a production of The Importance of Being Earnest. And when he stopped laughing, he very graciously said yes, which is how I came to have the honor of directing Mr. Crisp the first time he appeared on any stage as a character other than himself. Although, of course, it really was himself. And, of course, I didn't really direct him. I sort of said, well, you come over and sit there, and then you say it, and the others will move around you. And he did, magnificently, with the most incredible understanding of every nuance that Oscar Wilde had written, with the great wit, and with that underlying melancholy that was at the soul of all of Mr. Crisp's humor. And on one occasion, we were relaxing in the dressing room, and he said to me, you know, I could never really be an actor because I have no idea why any human being behaves as he does. But I do know where to put the semicolons.
Oh, well, not to cry. In that same production, I got myself appointed. I played Miss Prism to his Lady Bracknell, but I somehow got myself appointed as his dresser. And we were fond of each other even that long ago. I never called him anything but Mr. Crisp the entire 18 and a half years that I knew him well. And he never called me anything but Mrs. Thompson, except in that production, because the dresser, the movie of the dresser, was at the time very current, and we'd both seen it and loved it. He called me Norman. And, of course, I called him Sir. And that was the only first name that he ever called me. Anyway, just would like to end by saying to Mr. Crisp, hello, Mr. Crisp. This isn't Mrs. Norman Maine, but it is Norman, and good night.
As you listen to this voice on the radio, picture someone tuning into KPFT for the very first time, hearing what you just heard, a voice rescued by the Pacifica Radio Archives. Makes you a little proud, doesn't it? Radio from the archives is the best of the best, the kind of radio that inspires us all. I'm Deborah Bell of Queer Voices. Remember when you discovered KPFT? Perhaps a friend told you about an intriguing interview on Democracy Now!, or maybe you were just scanning the dial and stumbled upon the friendly and enlightening voices on a show, or found some music that you had never heard before. Or maybe you tuned in for the Pacifica Radio Archives, which are held internationally. However you find KPFT, it's evidently got you hooked. It's probably been a while since that discovery. Months, years, possibly even decades. A phone call to KPFT and a contribution brings you the same quality programming that you've valued since the first time you listened. Programming like the Pacifica Radio Archives doesn't appear out of nowhere. It's expensive to restore, but absolutely needed. After all, saving this sort of programming isn't a national initiative. There are no parades, festivals, and presidential speeches about saving our history. Preserving these voices for new generations is entirely up to you. Here's the number to call.
That number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make your tax-deductible contribution to KPFT. You are listening to a From the Vault special on the inimitable Quentin Crisp. Setting some of the stage for From the Memorial, we'll be getting a little bit later on in this hour into an interview with Quentin Crisp, more recordings of the man himself, and much, much more. But right now, we need to ask for your pledge of support. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director. You would normally hear queer voices during this program, and right now, we're asking for your pledge of support for KPFT sharing this treasure of a program, that of the life and times of Quentin Crisp. The number to call is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support right now for KPFT. Again, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. You can also go to kpft.org to make that pledge of support. Quentin Crisp, great CD set that is available from the Pacific Radio Archives. That CD set is called From the Vault, featuring Quentin Crisp, featuring the 1979 March on Washington, featuring some of the voices that you heard a little bit earlier this evening, remembering Stonewall, and so much more. That 100 hours of audio is available for your pledge of $200. That pledge is tax deductible. You can put it on a credit card. You can mail in your check. You can do an electronic funds transfer. However you'd like to make that pledge, please do it now. The number again, please dial 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support. 713-526-5738. We return to the From the Vault special on Quentin Crisp. Please give a call. 713-526-KPFT.
Performance artist and impersonator Steven Sorrentino.
I didn't realize how attached I was to Mr. Crisp. I got to live for a month with him. I got to survive for a month with him in Minneapolis when we filmed the movie Homo Heights. And I was a little embarrassed because in the movie I wore a dress, and Mr. Crisp and I always had a good relationship, and I was a regular Long Island kind of guy, and he was Mr. Crisp. And I put on the dress, and I said, "I'm a little embarrassed, what do you think?" And he looked close and said, "I think you look quite cozy." So we spent a month in heels together. It was incredible. I would just like to say from the bottom of my heart that when he was put in hospital for the first time, and I was a part of that, and I apologized till the last time we saw each other, for years, like Miss Arcade, I had to apologize. I brought to the hospital a beautiful robe with a big Q on it. And he said to me, "Why are you so kind to me?" And I thought, and I remember being a young man looking at the naked civil servant and saying, "I can be an individual. I could be myself. Because if a man like that has that kind of courage, and if that courage exists in a human being, then I certainly could be myself, no matter what." And I said, "Mr. Crisp, without you, there would be no me." And he just smiled. So I think right now that there's a chair and a drink, a real drink, as he'd say, up in heaven, and he's looking down, and he would hate all this fuss. But I think he would stop for a second and say just one word: lovely.
Anxiety is in the future, and regret is in the past. And betrayal is in other people. But in you, there is only yourself. There is only your happiness.
Next we hear from dramatist Tim Fountain.
There was the obligatory lunch at Cafe 99, because I think the Cooper Diner was closed at the time. And he sat in the window, and he received his meal free as recompense for sitting in the window. And he held forth for another 2 hours. Later, as we tottered home through the snow, I told him that he was contractually obliged to approve the script I was writing. In typical Quentin style, he said, "I accept whatever you write." And he did. I spoke to him a couple of weeks before he died, and I asked him if he'd received the play, and he said, "I've received it, but I haven't read it." He was far more interested in telling me about his hernia, which he said proudly was as big as an orange. Quentin never got to see the play, but I think he received word of what a big success it was. Night after night, an incredible cross-section of people, from Kensington ladies to Camden queens, sat rapt by his words and stories and Beck's portrayal of him. I think they marvelled at the sheer courage with which he lived his life. As Beck said in a tribute to him at the Royal Albert Hall, never forget that Quentin Crisp was out in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. He stayed out in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. And that's an incredible thing. When he passed away, some of the English press, and indeed some of the English gay press, tried to portray him as, to use Quentin's own phrase, a sad, lonely, embittered old queen. They were so wrong. I can't think of anyone who suffered as much and was less bitter or more generous with his time.
The only advantage of being an outsider to such an extent was that every day, just to live at all, was a kind of triumph.
Quentin's former agent and editor of The Wit and Wisdom of Quentin Crisp, Guy Kettlehack.
Asked to suggest the remedy for a broken heart, Quentin replied, "The remedy is to learn not to value love because it is requited. If you have love to give, you give it, and you give it where it is needed. Once you have this idea in your head, the idea of a broken heart will disappear." Asked if he believed in God, well, in a conversation with someone he knew would not take offense, his answer was simply no. But in his response to the question at a performance he gave in New Orleans, he gave an answer which, when I have read it to various Jesuit, Buddhist, and Orthodox Jewish friends, has met with their instantaneous and awestruck agreement. It's the closest to a manifesto I've ever heard Quentin make. Here it is. Do you believe in God? Well, now, the last time you know who was mentioned, I began by saying I wouldn't like to say anything that gave offense. And someone in the audience said, "Why stop now?" But this is still something that worries me, so if at any moment anyone finds anything I say offensive, they have only to jump up and down, make a scene, and we will stop. I believe, like most people, not that of which logic can convince me, but what my nature inclines me to believe. This is so of nearly everybody. I am unable to believe in a God susceptible to prayer as petition. It does not seem to me to be sufficiently humble to imagine that whatever force keeps the planets turning in the heavens is going to stop what it's doing to give me a bicycle with 3 speeds. But if God is the universe that encloses the universe, or if God is the cell within the cell, or if God is the cause behind the cause, then this I accept absolutely. And if prayer is a way of aligning your body with the forces that flow through the universe, then prayer I accept. But there is a worrying aspect about the idea of God. Like witchcraft or the science of the zodiac or any of these other things, the burden is placed elsewhere. This is what I don't like. You see, to me, you are the heroes of this hour. I do not think the earth was ever meant to be your home. I do not see the sky as a canopy held over your head by cherubs or see the ground as a carpet laid at your feet. You used to live an easy lying down life in the sea. But your curiosity and your courage prompted you to lift your head out of the sea and gasp this fierce element in which we live. They are seated on Mars with their little green arms folded, saying, "We can be reasonably certain there is no life on Earth, because there the atmosphere is oxygen, which is so harsh that it corrupts metal. But you learned to breathe it. Furthermore, you crawled out of the sea and you walked up and down the beach for centuries until your thigh bones were thick enough to walk on land. It was a mistake, but you did it. Once you have this view of your past, not that it was handed to you, but that you did it, then your view of the future will change. This terror you have of the atom bomb will pass. Something will arise which will breathe radiation if you learn to breathe oxygen. So you don't have to worry. Don't keep looking into the sky to see what is happening. Embrace the future. All you have to do about the future is what you did about the past. Rely on your curiosity and your courage and ride through the night.
When you have your style, you lay it at the feet of your neighbor. You don't get better than them. You don't put your style across other people. You offer it to them. It is not a question of getting the better of other people. It is not a question of being more peculiar than other people. When I was in Woking, a man said, "All you want us to do is wear funny clothes." I want you to wear funny clothes if you're funny people.
American composer and writer Ned Rorem.
No one was remotely like Quentin, with his extreme politeness, his unbitchy wit, and his basic common sense in the form of aphorism. With his death, the world weighs less.
Why do you consider it to be more fulfilling to be recognized for yourself rather than what you create? Because if it's for what you create, what good it will do you? You will be standing in a room at a party and someone will say, "Who's that over there?" And the reply will be, "Apparently he's a famous sculptor." What good is this? And people are always saying to me, perhaps people want their work to be recognized after their death. What good is that?
Actor John Hurt.
To conclude anything about Quentin, one would have to go to that which is essential, the essence of Quentin. He was a philosopher, and he is the only philosopher, to my knowledge, that actually lived his philosophy. He was a major, major figure of the 20th century, and he wasn't like anyone. He was literally unique.
All my life is given to the world. I don't have a life. I have very few hours in which I'm doing anything except sleeping or being with the world. Now, this I like. I've done it myself, and this is a life that I live.
You have been listening to highlights from the memorial service honoring visionary thinker Quentin Crisp. Thanks to Philip Ward, estate executor and organizer of the Quentin Crisp Foundation, www.crisperonto.org. John Hurt's tape courtesy of Professor Richard Connolly. Additional music composed by Evan Lurie for the film Homo Heights, which co-starred Mr. Crisp. The memorial program to Mr. Crisp was produced by Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials that we used, go online at www.fromthevaultradio.org or call Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres. Production coordinator, Edgar Toledo. Outreach by Sean Dellis. Business manager, Mariana Berkovich. And customer service, Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers, Alan Carmen and Shailendra Shakur. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer for From the Vault, please go to our website to find out how. Our theme music is courtesy of Los Angeles-based Parallel. For more information on Parallel and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. I need, don't know where to report. Oh, I've got.
This week on From the Vault Remembered, what we generally do is we actually bring in someone to talk about the topic for the week. This week's topic is actually Quentin Crisp, who had come out in the early 1900s. In 1920s, he came out and led a very out lifestyle, became a legend, and we're honoring his life this week on From the Vault. And what we normally do is Brian DeShazer, the director of the Pacifica Archive, is our host for the program. But this week, I'm sitting in just for this half hour. My name is Christopher Sprinkle. I produce From the Vault, and I'm going to talk to Brian DeShazer because he's going to be our special guest this week, because he had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Crisp back in the late 90s and also produced a memorial program that went on to win awards for Pacifica on the memorial of Quentin Crisp. And so I want to bring in Brian right now and ask him about that first time that you were able to meet Quentin Crisp here in Los Angeles.
Thanks, Christopher. So in Los Angeles, early 1999, Quentin Crisp was coming to Los Angeles with his one-man performance, An Evening with Quentin Crisp. And I've been trying to get an interview with him because in the Pacifica Radio Archives, I was new to the archive but found Quentin Crisp audio. I'm including a 1978 interview by Jessica Schumann, which included some of the clips from this actual performance. So I went to the theater and, you know, met with his manager, who was sort of, you know, distanced me and said that after the performance I might, you know, ask again if I could, you know, get an interview. And I brought recording equipment with me that I didn't really even know how to work, but at least I knew which button to push. So I get to the theater and I actually sat in the front row by myself, you know, in the center, and I sort of like stared at Quentin constantly as he sat, and we were only maybe about 6 feet away. Well, by intermission, you know, the manager comes up to me and says, Mr. Crisp would like to see you backstage. And I don't think that Mr. Crisp knew that I was the one that was trying to get, you know, an audience with him.
Did he just think you were cute? What was going on?
Well, we don't know. I would like to think so. So I think it was because I was staring at him so hard. So I went backstage, and, you know, he was just off in the wing by himself, and, you know, he was, you know, had a glass of scotch. And, you know, I sat down and asked him some questions, and we commented on his, you know, his brooch, and he commented on whatever I was wearing, and, you know, his scarves and his hats. And so he did, you know, honor me with an interview that I did, you know, at another time, you know, another night when he wasn't so tired. And it was really an incredible experience because he did mean so much to me in my own coming out. And, you know, The Naked Civil Servant was sort of the first film that I'd seen about a man who lived an out lifestyle. So he really was sort of a personal thing for me to, you know, use my workspace to go out and find a man that was, you know, sort of iconic to me. And it turned out that I did get that sort of personal relationship with him, you know, backstage, and he held my hand with one hand and drank the scotch with the other hand, and we really sort of just talked about life, you know, nothing major. So then I did the interview, and then, you know, after the interview, I didn't have interviewing skills, wasn't a journalist, and was sort of, you know, rambling through the interview, much more concentrating on my questions on the page than looking at him and listening. I think he said something really important, and I just sort of brushed it over and went on to the next question. But he was very sweet, you know, signed my book of The Naked Civil Servant, and was, you know, very happy. And then he, you know, later that year he passed away, almost 6 months later, I think. So in doing my research for the program and producing the memorial service, I found in the archive this 1978 interview with Jessica Schumann, which I think is really the most profound and most prolific recording, because it really does have clips of his performance, which are very rare, and also the interview, you know, the personal talk one-on-one, and where that art came from. Basically, he did the same performance for 25, 30 years, and it just changed, the dialogue just changed a little bit. But you can find from 1978, you know, lines that he said in 1999 when I saw him. It's the same show. But what was the first half was the same. That was scripted. The second half was all Q&A from the audience, and that changed constantly. So in the recording with the 1978 interview that we're about to hear, you can hear the audience questions, which are very dated almost. You know, they're very interesting to listen to of what somebody might have asked in 1978, and then I was at the same performance in 1999 and heard different kinds of questions. But his answers were the same.
Well, let's go ahead and hear the interview that Jessica Schumann did in 1978 with Quentin Crisp.
History may not have been your best subject in school, and that's okay. Voices like that which you've been hearing are better than what you would get in a classroom. I'm Chris Collins of the Ham Radio Show. You can rely on non-commercial radio to turn complicated studies into understandable language so you'll know how these ideas and advances will affect you. Non-commercial radio helps make complex ideas understandable. Ideas like member support. KPFT relies on your financial support to continue to bring you programs that are relevant to your life. Well over 90% of our budget comes from listeners. That money goes towards things like efforts to save recordings, like the ones you've been listening to. It's true. Saving important voices is not a national initiative. There are no presidential proclamations to rescue our history from the abyss. There are no parades. Whether these recordings live or die depends solely upon people like you. That's why we're asking you to make a contribution right now during this membership drive. Here's the number to call.
Yes, the KPFT is in the middle of their fund drive. And if you like what you've been hearing so far on what we've been broadcasting, you can please call 713-526-5738 and make a contribution. Or you can go to KPFT's website at kpft.org and click on the very secure PayPal button and make a donation that way. Again, 713-526-5738.
You are a member of a state legislature, and usually in a country this big, we don't hear very much about legislators in another state. But people know the name Elaine Noble. They know the name Julian Bond from Georgia. He's a state legislator. Why are you a nationally known figure? Why do you travel around the country? What is it that you're representing that people in other areas can identify with?
Okay, first of all, I don't travel around the country that much. I've traveled around and done some speaking engagements in this slot for a couple of political reasons. The first one was to help Tom Hayden, who I made a commitment to, and I think it's significant that I have to come across the country because he's about one of the few candidates that I feel has really kept alive the dream that we all really in the late 60s wanted to see happen and didn't. But I respect him, and I really think he'd be a good U.S. senator. I don't have that kind of candidate to support in my own state. I wish I did. But again, that's that political connection of trying to pull together people who care about a large movement. And a lot of us who still want to keep certain visions alive want to begin to build, I think, a grassroots movement to try and turn this country around. And you probably hear of my name because I'm such a terrific dancer.
He was reluctantly born on Christmas Day in 1908. To his dismay, he found himself to be the son of middle-class, middle-brow, middling parents who lived in Sutton, a suburb of London, England. After an uneventful childhood, he was sent between the ages of 14 and 18 to a school which was like a cross between a monastery and a prison. There he learned nothing that could be useful to him in adulthood except how to bear injustice. His ignorance of everything but this and his ambiguous appearance made any career impossible except in the arts. And this describes the early life of Quentin Crisp, also known and perhaps best known as the Naked Civil Servant. I'm Jessica Schumann, and today Quentin Crisp is my guest. Welcome.
Thank you.
You perhaps best exemplify Shakespeare's tenet that the world is a stage and we but players. Your whole life in recent years is an acting out of who you are. Perhaps you talk about how you evolved who you are, how you evolved this style that you've become notorious for. And you've said that it's certainly not famous, it's definitely notorious, whether you dabbled in other lifestyles, whether you had other images which you donned and then threw off because they didn't suit you, like a hat that didn't quite fit your head?
Well, I did, of course,
experiment to some extent, because everybody does. In the beginning, I was entirely unsure of myself, especially when I was at school. And when I was young, I alternately confirmed and denied my existence. But after a while, you can't keep that up. You have to make up your mind whether you're going to try and make yourself over to the world's opinion of what you should be like, or whether you're going to stay with what you find that you are. And what made the world cross was to find that I was so effeminate, what at school was merely thought to be feeble. I didn't want to play games, I didn't want to get hurt, and this annoyed everybody very much. And I would sometimes pretend that I was playing games and run round a field and try to get dirty. And then on other days I would think, no, this is nonsense. So I would lounge about saying, what is football? And so on. And it wasn't until I left school and went out into the world that I thought I must make up my mind. And then I decided that I would act out all the elements of my nature. The moment comes for everybody when he has to do deliberately what he used to do by mistake. And I suppose I realized this at about the age of 25. And from that moment onward, it was all clear to me what I should do. I should adopt an appearance which told everybody what they seemed so desperately to want to know. Because if there are only two people left in the world alive, one thing will live with them, and that is the curiosity of the one about the sex life of the other. And so, since this seemed to matter to everybody, to an extent where, because I wore makeup and dyed my hair, the crowds followed me through the streets to the extent where you could not get the traffic through the streets, we have to say that this is something they wanted to know. So I made it possible for them to know instantly, when they saw me, exactly who and what I was.
But Quentin Crisp is a lot more than those outward appearance factors.
Yes. And now, of course, I've gone to the very edge of exhibitionism, because inevitably the time comes when you find yourself moving from statement to protest. You find yourself doing things not to please yourself, but to annoy the neighbors. And you have to move back again, because it is as absurd to try to offend the neighbors as it is to try to ingratiate yourself with them. What you have to do, as I see it, is to decide what you would be like if there were nobody else in the world. What would you do if you had only yourself to consider? And once you've decided that, you do it, and you be it, and you stay with it for an entire lifetime. And then you have a core, you have some certitude inside yourself about the rightness of what you're doing in your own eyes.
You've said that lifestyle for you is a religion.
Lifestyle for me is, yes, it is a way of going on, so that it would cover everything, so that if a crisis were to arise, I could say, is what I am doing or saying or wearing or thinking compatible with my lifestyle?
I would imagine that it would be harder and harder for you and for many other people to find a sense of individuality. There is so much flamboyance. There is so much extravagance. There is so much theatricality. Certainly in Los Angeles, the tinsel town of the world, I'm sure you've noted that walking down the boulevard in Hollywood, that everybody is out to show off and to outdo their neighbor.
Yes, this is true. And audiences have said to me, what would you do if you found yourself outstyled? Well, of course, there's no such thing. You don't have to be more outrageous than other people. You don't have to do anything about other people. You never make any comparison between yourself and others. You simply have to be more and more like yourself. And so, of course, if you look into your soul
and find that you're ordinary, then ordinary you must be. But if possible, you must be so ordinary that you can imagine someone saying, come to my party and bring your humdrum friend, and that means you.
When you looked into your soul, when you searched the interior realm of your being, what did you find? Can you put that in words?
I found that most of my mental characteristics were feminine, in spite of my body being masculine. And this is what worried everybody so much. My problem from the beginning was not a sexual problem, it's what Jan Morris calls a gender problem. It was a personality problem. And this worries people very little now. When the young people say to me, well, what was it all about? And I say, well, I did dye my hair, they say, and then? Because it makes no difference to them. But I come from a world where the difference between the sexes was so great that there were whole vocabularies which were suitable for men to use. No man in the middle classes of England, when I was young, would have said anything was lovely or marvellous. There were the clothes you could wear, there were the movements you could make, even the facial movements. No man ever rolled his eyes or smiled from ear to ear. Englishmen have very small facial movements. And so anything else was what my friends call a dead giveaway. And you had to learn all this, or else do without it. You had to do the things which were natural to you and lump the consequences. But there were whole occupations which were women's work. My father wouldn't have boiled a kettle because it was woman's work, and that meant degrading, which is a pretty terrible state of affairs. And I'm very pleased that even in England, the sexes are more friendly now than they were in a time gone by. But still, to this day, Englishmen do not really like the society of women.
What if you've been born into a different society where equality was accepted and no one really was too concerned over appearance, over gender identification, a rather polymorphous, perverse society? How would your life have been different if no one really cared whether you liked to sew or you liked to cook, whereas others did not?
Oh, undoubtedly my personality would have been much less shrill. I would have been able, as you say, to do these things without doing them in defiance of the world. And I would probably have been much more pleasant to know. The trouble with a lot of people who have a personality problem is not that people dislike the personalities they manifest. It's that people get bored with the fact that they never talk about anything else. And this would not have applied to me if there had been no problem.
I would imagine, though, if you stripped away all the antagonism, though, you would be left with, well, without a raison d'etre, perhaps.
Well, of course, it did become the meaning of my life. That's quite true. It became, in the beginning, a crusade. And I thought that I represented all the effeminate people in the world, which of course is rubbish. I merely represented myself. But it did give, in my case, an interest to my life that a lot of people may otherwise not have. To live through a single day was a kind of triumph.
I think that would heighten your existence tremendously. In a way, you're fortunate, then.
In a way, I'm fortunate. All outsiders of any kind do have this fact that they bring to bear on every situation all they have, instead of merely taking it or leaving it, not really considering it very deeply. Every person you meet is a potential antagonist, and you spend your time making them over, working away at them, winning them over. Your life is one long, tentative flirtation with the world.
When you talk about style, I'm tempted to think of artifice, guise, masks. And I'm wondering whether you see these two concepts, these two ideas, as linked in any way.
Oh, I think they are. What I mean by style is the opposite of this. Mr. Wilde said that in matters of great importance, it wasn't sincerity that mattered, but style. And this, to me, means that he wasn't truly a stylist, because, to me, sincerity and style are the same thing. Just as in literature, style is not a question of raining down encrusted, bejeweled passages on rather banal material. Style in literature is removing all the words which don't say what you really mean. And in the same way, in style in life, you have to find some way of leaving nothing of yourself to doubt, so that everybody does understand who you are, what you are, what you mean by what you say.
So in other words, you pare down everything that's non-essential, mm-hmm. and you get to that core, the economy, mm-hmm. that expresses your inner essence through
yes,
style.
That's right.
That's not the way the word is usually used, I don't think.
This is true. And this is a problem, and this I do have to explain in the theater. And I try to explain it in various ways.
One of the things that I think is utterly wonderful about the message, and indeed you come to America with a message that isn't dissimilar.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.